Regardless of where you were born, what your degree is in, what you do for a living, change is something that impacts your personal and professional lives. I was in LA at the time, just finished my undergrad, cut my teeth in a boutique management consulting firm, and proceeded to get bored out of my mind. I just felt like every project was the same, every client was the same. Around about the year 2000, that's when the subprime mortgage fallout occurred. It was only then change management started to be recognized as a real discipline. And so I started from nothing. I took a 40% pay cut and I started as a change analyst. And I just worked my way up with unwavering dedication and laser-like focus. 7 years later, I ended up being the youngest GM of change at a big gold mining company. Take off the Superman cape. Like, one person, no matter how amazing they are, cannot change an entire organization. And that's when you need to rely on your networks and your relationships and your peers to help build momentum. So it's not you yourself that's carrying the baton. So let others help you carry the load. The illiterate of the future will not be those that cannot read or write, but those that cannot learn, relearn, and unlearn. So learning's great, but unlearning is just as important. So what are those mindsets, behaviors, etc., that are holding you down, that are keeping you tethered to where you are today? And how can you start to systematically unlearn them?
So Friska, hello, how are you?
I'm good, thanks.
So nice to have you.
Thanks for having me.
I really enjoyed our chat the other day. Friska and I haven't known each other for a long period of time, but we certainly swim in similar circles. And I think we had some interesting philosophy around a topic very close to my heart, which is change and transformation. So super keen to chat today, my friend. Today, before I kind of throw the ball about getting to know you, I thought I would ask a very different question to what I'm able to ask the normal audience, because I think this is such an important topic to nail. What do you hope that we get out of today's conversation for everyone listening along?
I think that regardless of where you were born, what your degree is in, what you do for a living, change is something that impacts your personal and professional lives. And the better we understand it, the better we'll be able to manage it, and the better for all our sakes. And when I say all our sakes, it's just not just our mental health, but our financial health as well. Now, your big interchange and transformation, at the end of the day, no progress occurred without change. However, not all change results in progress. So, you know, which camp do you fall into?
I love it. I love it. So that's that. I want to get in the guts of that with you, Friska. Now, Friska has, for anyone who doesn't know, and if you haven't looked at the show notes, The Future Fit for Organization. This is a triple bestseller. Very good book. I would encourage you to read that. But let's get into it. So transformation, let's start there. Now, Friska, you found yourself in this world. Most people land in it as a matter of experience and a matter of requirement as part of a corporate career. But how did you land in transformation land?
I jumped into it. That's that's more accurate. I was in LA at the time, just finished my undergrad, cut my teeth in a boutique management consulting firm, and proceeded to get bored out of my mind. I just felt like every project was the same, every client was the same. Around about the year 2000, that's when the subprime mortgage fallout occurred. So I went back to Australia, thought it was a sign. And it was only then change management started to be recognized as a real discipline. And it really intrigued me because it played to all my strengths. So it's the diversity of the day, like every day is different. There's no cookie cutter approach because what works for company A is not going to work for company B. Every culture is different. Every person driving the change is different. And the change itself is often different. So it played to all my strengths about communication, developing trust and rapport, interpersonal influence across cultures. And I thought, oh, I want to try this out. And back then, no one was willing to give me a go. And so I started from nothing. I took a 40% pay cut and I started as a change analyst. And I just worked my way up with unwavering dedication and laser-like focus. And since then, you know, fast forward 7 years later, I ended up being the youngest GM of change at a big gold mining company. But I intentionally sought changes of all different types, mergers and acquisitions, operating model restructures, many, many digital transformations, and even literally physical changes, physical relocations for thousands of organizations. So that's really got what got me to where I am today.
Oh, mate, there's a bit in that. Can I ask? So transformation. So most of it, there's certain types of people that listen to this. There's various business leaders, people who are motivated to hear from, you know, talented people like yourself and sort of understand a bit more about that and reflect on their own development. And there's entrepreneur types, you know, business owners who would be growing and scaling their company. So there's a few different types of people that we typically find listen to this, but transformation just gets overused, in my opinion. So can you, before we get into the guts of some of those experiences or maybe some discussion about change and transformation, what is the definition of a genuine transformation?
So transformation is a complete reimagining of how an organization produces value. So most people claim they're doing a transformation, but really it's a glacial evolution. Like implementing technology doesn't mean you're doing a transformation. So I think a good example of that is one of my former clients, which is quite a large engineering company. Their focus has been on large infrastructure projects, but they're transforming and they're wanting to circle back to their roots, which is in sustainability. So that means they stop chasing for the big infrastructure projects. They actually, like, it's not just a matter of, hey, here's our value, we're going to do sustainability projects now. So the way they make money, the way they hire, the skills that they build are totally different from the way that they're doing things yesterday.
Yeah, nice. And are they, you know, when you look at that definition, what you talked about, the word value comes up, right? And I often have this challenging conversation with some people in various corporate environments or large organizations, not even be able to determine the value they're seeking before the change that they're trying to introduce. Tell us about, you know, when you look at, you know, that engineering example is a good one. When you're looking at the typical conversation with an organization about transformation, how often is value the starting point?
Not as often as it should be. Often when change starts to be discussed, it's more of a hair on fire situation where something's gone wrong and it's a bit of a rescue job. But ideally, it should be right at the very beginning and fleshed out in the business case. Like, what are the benefits? What does it enable? Otherwise, you're just changing for change's sake.
I asked that for a slightly leading question, but from my experience, that happens all the time. And depending on where you are in the organization, the person you're talking to, their relationship with it, and what value even means is often a bit opaque. It's a bit rusty. So can you tell us, because again, going back to change, whether it's a small organization or large organization, what are the ingredients you start to overlay on a successful transformation that genuinely lands, that gets the result, gets the value creation that we're seeking, and brings people, you know, along the journey in the right way?
So I call it the 4S system, and it's support, systems, structure, and skills. So a successful transformation at the end of the day needs to be supported at the very top. There's no point trying to encourage grassroots innovation and change if people aren't empowered to do something about it. So that's the first S. So top-down support. So leaders need to upskill themselves on what it means to be a great change leader. It's not just signing off on budget. It's not just doing the rah-rah at a town hall. You actually need to roll up your sleeves and help manage resistance, like proactively leverage your network to develop momentum for the change. The second is skills. So depending on the type of change you're trying to drive, you can't expect people to pony up and do it immediately. Like, they need to be given the skills to do that, whatever that skill set is. It could be you're trying to improve your culture, so they need training on how to have constructive feedback conversations, or it could be very specific, like a particular engineering niche. So that's the skills. Structures. Change needs to be integrated into the organization structure to reflect this is just the way they want to do business now. So there's no point, for example, I was at a large engineering company. Again, I've got a lot of engineering experience, and they were trying to drive an offshoring program. So standing up delivery centers in lower cost countries to increase profits. Sounds great. However, what they failed to understand is that the people that are in charge of sending the work, they're not remunerated against how cheap they can do a project. They're remunerated, and their bonuses were tied to customer satisfaction, on-time delivery, none of those things aligned to the change. So structurally, there was a mismatch, there was a clash. So those sort of misalignments need to be identified and need to be structurally aligned. And last but not least is the systems. So there's no point embedding a change, not having the right systems, and then you come back a month later and it's gone back to the way it was. So systems could mean rewriting job descriptions. Systems could mean constantly having a plan in case to reinforce the vision and unearth these great benefits that are being achieved. So rarely does an organization have all four, and they must be integrated.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, and it's complex, right? There's all those
moving
parts.
Easy, everybody else were doing it.
Yeah, exactly. So it's partly why I find it so intriguing. I like the complexity of it. But the average person, you know, and executives, you know, busy looking at day-to-day, managing current function, BAU, there's the pressure of external forces, could be shareholders, could be other third parties that are putting thought process in there. And then some leaders are very astute at doing this sort of work, and others aren't. What do you find when you see a brilliant change leader? What do you notice in them? You talked about that support first S, and that's ultimately what I'm alluding to. Yeah. What does a brilliant change leader look like in your opinion?
So they are active and visible. They don't hide in their corner office. They are authentic when they do show up. Like if they support it, they tell people why, not only why they support it, but how they'll support people further down the chain. They build a coalition, and you have to be bold and brave to do this. Like you have to put your neck out on the line and say, you know what, I'm going to back this, and I want you as my peer to back this too because of A, B, and C. And they don't take no for an answer. Like if people resist, they don't see that as a bad sign. Like resistance is a completely normal response to change. It protected us in the prehistoric era when we were being eaten by dinosaurs. Now, not so helpful, and we still do that. But they don't think, yep, that person's resistant, I'm just going to give up. They keep on chipping away bit by bit. Right? Change doesn't happen overnight. It doesn't happen with one conversation. It needs many conversations. And very rarely does a leader have the grit, the patience, and the stamina to do that. And last but not least, it sounds really simple, but they do need to communicate directly. And this is often something most leaders have the difficulty with doing. It doesn't come naturally. So a lot of leaders, they're in that position because maybe they were technically brilliant, they've been promoted up, et cetera, et cetera. They've never had to work on their RQ, their relational intelligence.
So when you say direct, tell me, what do you mean by direct communication? Are you suggesting that's succinct, to the point, unambiguous? Is that what you mean by direct?
Yes, and face-to-face.
And face-to-face,
face-to-face. It doesn't have to be one-on-one. It could be one-to-many. But you as the leader, people want to see you. They want to understand what makes you tick. They want to understand why they should invest all this time, energy into learning something new. Why should they change? They want to know.
Yeah. I'm going to, and I'm not going to ask this question from the point of view, I believe it, but I'm asking this question because it's, you know, it's a little bit of a skeptic's hat. But there are some leaders out there that would argue that an employee is working for them and the change is required and change is necessary in business. And there's healthy resistance and there's unhelpful resistance.
Yes.
And really, you're employed to come along the journey or maybe jump off the bus. Is there also, like, in terms of creating that learning opportunity, is it incumbent on employees in 2024 to independently become more change resilient? And what are your views around how employees can start to consider that relationship between what their boss is expected to create in terms of an environment versus how they're meant to respond as an individual?
I think change resilience is a useful skill no matter what job you have. Like, it's going to just set you up for success. And it really depends on that psychological contract that you have with your employer. Like, some people really don't care. They're like, look, you want to do another change? Sure, I'll support it, whatever. And some people feel strongly about something. So you can't really paint everybody with the same brush. But I think if you are being paid to be there, then you have, I think you have a responsibility to at least hear your leaders out on why they're going down this particular route of action. And, but change has historically not been managed well in the past, and that's the difficulty. As soon as someone gets up and says, hey, we're doing this change, straight away that has a knee-jerk negative response and people check out. I think also we are really change fatigued. I mean, the pandemic just seemed like it was yesterday when we were all home. It seemed like every single week there was a new change. Like, oh, social distancing, 5 people. Oh, no, 2 people. Oh, no, 5 kilometers. It's like one thing after another. So our change reserves have been tapped out. So I think the key is to not impose a tidal wave of change of people, but bite-sized incremental chunks. Mm-hmm. Because we're all busy, we're all time poor. There's information coming at us left, right, and center. There's only so much willpower that we have to absorb what's coming down the line. So I'm having to, in my work, smaller and more frequent touch points and engagements to get people on board.
Mm-hmm. That's you know, I can empathize with that. I think anyone on the call listening to this can empathize with the fact that there's been so much change, and it probably won't slow down, but or it might even look different based on what we experience. But you know, I wonder when you share that story around bite-sized communication, that's for some very different. Where have you seen that done well, where there's an adjustment to better bite-sized communication and supportive change? And maybe you can give us a practical example. And maybe just so people understand what bad looks like, can you talk us through examples of where the communication models around change and transformation are just fundamentally broken and the management team have a massive blind spot? So tell us, just so people can actually sort of see the contrast.
Let's just talk about COVID for a second, because I think we all understand that and have gone through it. So a country that did this really well was Singapore.
Mm-hmm.
They were very clear. Every day they'd release a little bit of information. They didn't bombard people. There was no scaremongering tactics.
Mm-hmm.
They knew who they were engaging. They knew their audience, and that is appealing to the collectivist culture, wanting to good for society, they focused on the greater good. And that worked because the compliance rate for like following the rules was like 90-something%. When communication didn't work, I'd say was here in Australia. I had the first lockdown experience in Melbourne and it was very, very confusing. There were no common terms of reference. What does close contact mean? What does it not? And people didn't know what to do. So I think that's an example of change communication gone wrong. Terminology was vague. There was no definition spelled out for people. And in terms of the leaders, it didn't do them any good in compliance when we saw the PM gallivanting around picnicking in the park.
Breaking a few of those rules you talked about there. And that's easy to see at a government level in Australia. I mean, most of the listeners of this podcast are Australian, and I think it was poor. But when you look at that story about Singapore from a cultural standpoint, right, if we think about our own businesses, it by nature, you know, and maybe this is just something that you'll know more about the Singapore culture, but compliance is a natural tendency for that culture, and so in Australia we tend to buck the trend a little bit and just play against the rules because we are that way inclined.
Oh, totally agree.
So because of that, is that part of what you look at when you're transforming a business, when you're looking at improvement or change, or deliberate change? Are you starting to understand what is the culture and what is the tendency or the relationship people have with change in this culture?
You have to understand not just the organizational culture, but the ethnic cultures that are prevalent within their workforce.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, the Singapore culture is more erring on the compliance side, but don't forget there are a lot of expats in that country. And they towed the line just as much as the locals did.
Okay. Your work, as I say, I have a really close relationship with transformation, and I'm massive around cultural change because I think the culture that underpins a change either makes it successful or not. And you know, a lot of organizations are talking about, you know, having adaptability in their, you know, embedded in their culture, a sense of embrace for innovation, embrace for this change, normalizing it to some degree. What are you seeing culturally organizations do well when it comes to developing that type of culture that enables change, knowing that even if there's not a very strong, heavy transformational agenda right now, which there normally is, but even if there's not, that they're actually gearing themselves up for the future and further deliberate change.
There's a lot of talk about agility, innovation, growth, et cetera, but often they're just words on a wall. Those values are not practiced. They're simply professed. And the difference between those that just talk about it and those that are actually doing the work is that they normalize that conversation. So I can't remember what the company is called, but there's a company in Sweden and every Friday they celebrate F-ups. So they celebrate failure because it's not failure, it's actually a learning. So if we're serious about learning and innovation, we need to reward people for giving it a go, not just when it works, but when it stuffs up as well, because then they've learned something and they'll do better next time. And that learning will accelerate the time to value. Mm-hmm. So unless we have rituals like that, not much innovation is going to occur.
Yeah.
Right? We have to totally review how we reward people, what are these organizational practices that we want to embody. And we also need a different sorts of leaders.
There's an old mentor of mine that told me a story about this, and he talks about two dogs. And they go out into the wilderness, and one's a dark dog and one's a light dog.
Yeah.
And he asked the question, you know, it's got prey, it's got predators everywhere. Yeah. So which one survives? And the answer is the one you feed. Right. And we talk about this, you know, a lot in behavior around the behavior we feed.
Yeah.
How often when you're looking at, I know you get the chance to talk to lots of leaders, and this is partly why I asked the how often question, but when you're talking to leaders, how often are they actually really deliberate around understanding the behavior change that's required and the specific behavior we're trying to feed that enables the broader transformation?
Not enough. Mm-hmm. No, they're focused on here's the benefits of this particular transformation, make it happen. And often the change is assessed on difficulty to implement, like how many people are needed, rate of technical expertise, et cetera, when we should be looking at what is the impact of the change. So what are we going to do first? Are we going to do smaller impact, easier to understand change, to whet the appetite for bigger change? Like that will usually set, especially a larger organization, up for success. So minimize the risk, start small, smash it out, you know, make a really good successful pilot and use that as a wedge to encourage other people to adopt.
Mm-hmm. Almost that first follower idea, right? Get the momentum.
You remember that video, right, of the random dude dancing by himself then at the end of it, everybody's dancing with him.
Yeah.
It's the same. Like when we go overseas and we're traveling, we're thinking about where to go for dinner. We walk past a few restaurants. We're not going to go to the one that's only got one table in it.
Yeah.
We're going to the busy one.
Yeah.
Same.
Yeah.
We rely on social proof to make decisions as much as we don't like to admit it.
Yes. And so if the more we understand human behavior, the easier this stuff becomes. So if that's the case, it's that what you described before is a hugely financially driven, structurally driven discussion that's happening around transformation as the forefront. And I get that, because ultimately if we can't measure it, we can't manage it. Yeah. But there seems to be a deficit around the behavioral side is what you're saying to me. What's, in your opinion, what's driving that, and where, how do you help people reframe their attention so that they can go into that, the other side, the human side of the change?
So what's driving, I mean, numbers are very easy to paint. It's very black and white. These are the benefits, these are not. And what I think a lot of organizations don't do is they don't circle back. They don't do a post-mortem and say, hey, we said we'd save $5 million, you know, a year after we do this. Have we done that? If not, why? So I've got friends that have, you know, exited a lot of big banks, et cetera, that have huge change management teams, but there's no accountability. So whatever you put in the business case, no one's coming back to you and saying, hey, did that actually happen? So I think that's a big reason why the big sexy numbers get the tick of approval. And the second reason would be it's really hard to measure non-financial benefits of a change because people are emotional, people are irrational, and there's not a lot of good change people out there.
That's, given that's so true, and I'd argue anyone listening to this, anyone has moments where they're completely irrational and they know it.
Yep.
And they have moments where their staff or their team or their boss or their business partner is completely irrational. Mm. So we know that. Why, in spite of knowing that, and why, in spite of 80% of change mm-hmm. programs failing
yep.
by definition based on the business case set out in the yep. first place, that's you know, a bit of research around that. Why, based on that, are we still making the same mistakes in your opinion?
People, because it's all they know and they don't want to stick their neck out for doing something different and for it to fail anyway. I think the stakes are higher now, especially with the rise of technology and this transparent culture that we've got. It's very easy to have one stuff up, be reverberated across the front page of the newspaper all across the country.
Mm.
So I think there's more at stake.
There's more at stake.
People are more connected. We're borderless.
So for the employees listening to this, and it may not be, but many, but if I'm an employee and I'm working in an environment and the executive committee's, you know, announced some change strategy or a transformation, what would you say the hope is of it being an effective change? And what would they need to ask about to know that they're going to be in a good position in terms of getting that value, not only in terms of for the business, but in terms of the department they're working for?
For them to ensure change is a good experience, like, they would need to know what exactly it is, why it's happening, specifically how it will impact not just them but their department, their ways of working, et cetera, and to really be on the front. Like, if you're vague about how something's going to roll out, like, put your hand up and ask. Like, it's in your best interest to prepare yourself. Also, you need to make use of the opportunities to get involved, to participate and get educated on this.
Yep.
So a good change person will map all that out. That's part of the strategy. Here's the comms plan. Here's the engagement plan. Here's training. Here's the reinforcement plan. And so if you find that you're not being involved enough, then put your big boy pants on or put your big girl heels on and ask to be more involved so you can better understand it.
Yeah.
And sorry, I want to go back to your point about why still 80% of projects don't meet the objectives set out in the business case. So I'm a huge believer that there's a person missing around the boardroom table. So I've written about this for the AICD, and that's chief change officer, mm-hmm. right? 10 years ago, there was no chief digital officer. There was no chief customer officer. Mm-hmm. If we are all in violent agreement, change is only going to happen faster. It's more far-reaching and complex than ever. Doesn't it make sense that someone around that table is always thinking, how is this going to impact the business? How is this going to impact our employees? How is it going to impact our vendors and customers? What are we going to do about it? I think it's nonsensical to think you can future-proof yourself, because some changes we have no idea what's going to happen, right? Look at COVID. Even the countries that have experienced SARS were totally caught off guard. So to think we can future-proof ourselves is a bit arrogant. But what we can do is build our resilience. Mm-hmm. So we can build our future fitness. And that's what most organizations are not doing.
Is that why you wrote the book?
Mm.
What motivated you to write the book?
After 10 years leading change for some of the biggest names in mining, engineering and tech, like, there were a few patterns that came out. And I think that, you know, we on average spend about 80,000 hours of our lives at work. And I read a report last year by the Australian Institute of Management that how change is managed has like an 80% impact on an employee's mental health and well-being. So there's a huge opportunity to make change an experience where you don't just bounce back from challenges, you actually bounce forward. You actually bounce forward stronger, more resilient, more agile, and stronger than you were before.
Yeah.
That's why I wrote the book.
Yeah, nice. And it sounds like you've become stronger yourself. What have been moments in your own career? Now, you talked about it earlier, you've been through plenty of these projects and you've been in senior roles, but where have you learned the biggest lessons and where have you found that you've bounced back stronger as a result of those lessons?
So it would have to be, this is where I learned that no matter what you do, some people are completely irrational. Like, I've had a guy maybe like that far from my face yelling at me full pelt because he was losing his car parking privileges. And I think A, that was a lesson that what's important to everybody else is totally different to what someone else may deem important. And that's when I started to understand why people, I knew people feared change and were resistant, but what were they scared of losing? And that's when I sat down and thought, okay, what is it? What is this guy scared of? What does he not want to lose? And it was prestige, right? And since then I've developed a model. So people are either scared of losing prestige, so their self-esteem, their position, obviously, their pay, their performance, and their protection. So every single negative response to a change is one of those P's that's driving it, one or more.
Okay, interesting. Yeah. So you can diagnose and assess, or theorize at least.
Theorize, yeah.
On what we might see through the five P's you've just put there.
Yeah.
Now, prestige is an interesting one because there's often an attachment. Human beings like to be attached to what they think is important.
Yeah.
And often these changes don't necessarily, sometimes don't change their job profile, but they'll change the way they're working. And there's this sense of not knowing.
Mm.
There's a sense of not understanding enough. Mm. It's almost like a sense of losing in the process. Now, is that a prestige issue or is that more of a performance control issue? What do you see in that? Because that's so common in my experience.
It could be. Well, if this particular person was known for like being the shit, like he knows everything about this particular thing and now that thing is being changed, then that could be a prestige and a performance thing.
Mm.
Because it's going to be harder for him to sustain that A-plus performance if he's no longer the expert in whatever it was that's being changed.
Mm, interesting. Mm. The idea that happens all the time, right, and you just talked about five different pieces, that can be pretty overwhelming for the average manager, you know, for the business owner with the team, you know, even if we go down to the smaller tier, team of 20, 15, 10 people deciding to deliberately change their business. How do you, because I'm sure as in your consulting work, you're helping people cope as leaders through this.
Mm.
What are the common conversations you're having? What are the discussions you're having about effectively navigating this, given you see it without the emotional lens of having the other baggage that they've got to carry? What are the common discussions you're having?
I like to remind them that they can take off the Superman cape. Like one person, no matter how amazing they are, cannot change an entire organization. And that's when you need to rely on your networks and your relationships and your peers to help build momentum. So it's not you yourself that's carrying the baton. So let others help you carry the load.
That load, I'd imagine, because you know, I've been through that myself and I'm sure you have, but are there times where you've had that superwoman, superman cape on? And what'd you learn from that?
Never underestimate the power of a really visible, influential person on your credibility and the amount of that, how it can shortcut getting things done. So I'm a huge believer in setting someone up for success. And when I say set someone up for success, it's how they're introduced. It's how you kind of, one second. How they introduce, it's their mandate to innovate, it's the sponsorship that they have, and it's the authority. So I think when you have your Superman cape on, remember, see who else has got a bigger cape and see if they can lend you a bit of their cape until you can start to grow your own.
Yeah, interesting. Can you give us a practical example of where that's played out or how that's been described? Maybe you've been the person endorsed.
You a time that it went down like a blaze of glory. I was so annoyed.
Okay.
I was being introduced for the first time ever to the senior leadership team of a 50,000 employee business. It was a new project, exciting. And the program director said, oh, yeah, and this is Friska. She just makes things look pretty. And in that room was the CEO and the CFO. And I had no idea what to do, because I'd never met any of them before. Thought, God, do I say something? Do I not? And because I knew the culture was ultra conservative, I chose not to say anything. But kudos to him, the CFO who'd never met me before, actually piped up and said, I'm sure that's not all she does. And I've had a look. She's got more degrees than you, John. So like he kind of saved the day. But if he wasn't there, that stigma, that first impression would have been, I would have been carrying that for the rest of the project. Mm. So that's when it didn't go well. And that was very early in my career. And I had no idea what to say when that situation came up. And the time that it has gone well was when I was introduced to a massive site. There are about 1,000 people, all huge in high vis and steel cap boots, and there's me. And the GM of the site said, this is Friska, you have to listen to her. This culture change is important to us and this is how it'll benefit you. And she's here to understand how things are done around here. I want you to give her her time, because when you give her her time, you are giving me my time. That introduction took 10 seconds.
Powerful though. Mm. Yeah. I want to circle back to I think you used the name John, but whoever that situation was, what would Friska do today if that happened? Because I know you know how important it is to have a sense of purpose and command and I guess agency in the role of leading change, whether you're a consultant or an internal leader. Mm. What would your approach be to managing perhaps a poor introduction?
My comeback to that, given that if I could rewind again, I'd say something like, given the percentage of the benefits of this particular program depends on doing things differently, it's actually at 90%, I'd say I do more than make things pretty around here. Otherwise, there's no point for this project.
Yeah. If all I'm doing is making things pretty, I don't think you need me.
No.
There's enough pretty paintings and PowerPoints,
yeah, exactly,
and all sorts of things.
I'm not a PowerPoint jockey. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. And I don't know if sometimes you wonder if people do things maliciously or if they're just a little bit silly.
Silly for sure, because he came up to me after that meeting and apologized profusely. He goes, I don't know why the hell I said that. Like, I'm so sorry. Like, I've actually got a 17-year-old daughter and I'd be mortified if someone introduced her like that.
Mm.
But what could I say? It was done.
It was done. And that's the interesting part around change. It's being deliberate, isn't it? It's being considered. It's being planned. I have this conversation all the time around the fact that we have these knee-jerk reactions that are so avoidable.
Mm.
Small organizations through to very large, complicated things, and they're not hard. And often the person in control or maneuvering through those changes understands that they're not silly either. Mm. You know, they're not, and they're also more often than not wanting to see the change succeed.
Mm.
So, you know, when you talked about systems before, right, and you talked about some organizing frameworks or ways to organize the process of taking people through change, whether it's a PD or a meeting or a town hall or a change to the way we measure. What do you see as important as a practice or practices that might be important that help people avoid those knee jerks of avoiding those avoidable pitfalls?
Definitely plan. When you agree ahead of time what your key messages are, and not just that, but what are the likely questions people will have? Those really curly questions. And you can't just decide on this by yourself. Like, get the brains trust in, right? The more people, the better. People that are familiar with the organization, are familiar with the department you're about to talk to, are familiar with the CEO, and get all the poison out. Get the possible worst case questions, curly questions, and make sure you agree upfront what the answers will be. There's nothing worse than, like, let's look at the Woolies CEO interview, right? He was totally caught off guard, didn't know what to say, and had to be taken off by his PR company. Mm. Like, you can't recover from that. And it's the same with change. Make sure you know what you're going to say to kind of curly questions, and make sure your leadership team is all on the same hymn sheet.
Mm.
Because that wavering of credibility, it's just going to send shockwaves throughout the organization.
Yeah. And in that, right, there's this sense of direction, right? There's this sense of we're going over here to the mountain and we're going to do it this way.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, and you know, I've got theories around this, but I'd love your thoughts. At the same time, people want to feel consulted. They want to feel engaged around the direction. They want to feel that often a lot of the feedback that I've seen in poor change is that I wasn't consulted and therefore I wasn't able to add input into what I think could have been a better change or a better result, right? So where's that balance lie, and how do you see leaders getting better at providing clear direction but also navigating consultation?
It really depends on, A, your budget, how big your organization is, what the timeline is. So for me, that's kind of varied, and I want to distinguish between giving people a voice versus giving people a vote. Mm-hmm. Like, giving people a voice is quite easy. Whip up a survey, condense the insights, reflect that back to the organization. And when you reflect it back, it shows that you heard them. Yes, you've considered it. However, you're doing this. There's nothing worse than not even having the opportunity to have a voice. So my kind of litmus test is roughly 10% of the population and from a cross-section. So not just the senior leadership team, not just middle management. So I just did a project for another large organization, which is all about creating their 2030 vision. So from there, that's when I suggested the 10%, and people really felt consulted.
Yeah, nice. So 10%, we've been heard. We've got some data. We're showing it back to you. Yes. We're indicating that we want to do something that's not right for the
business.
We've
heard you.
But yeah, great.
And this is the thing. It's not me going out there and canvassing 10% of 500 people. Like, that's why you need a coalition. That's why you need a change agent or change champion network. So I leverage on them to identify high performers in their organization, and they are my arms and legs that help this happen.
Yeah. You and I talked offline, and it sort of builds on that point you just made there, but we talked offline about resistance, but then we talked about apathy, you know, and, you know, I've seen, you know, government and, you know, sort of organizations that have this, you know, fatigue, but also, just a sense that the change is happening to them, and there's almost an apathy for some staff members that this no longer matters anymore, or whatever, you know, I'm not bought in, but I'm also not moving.
Yeah.
You know, are there things that we can do to ensure, and what do you think, maybe before we get into that, what do you see is the difference between resistance and apathy, and why is it important to look out for it?
Resistance means they're still engaged. So they're engaged, but they're upset about it because of A, B, and C, whatever. Apathy is completely checked out, like do not care, not responding, just meh. So apathy is the worst case scenario. It's the hardest to come back from.
It is. Apathy is completely hard to come back from. And I'm sure you've seen plenty of cultures. What do you notice about cultures that cultivate and seem to develop a nucleus of people that seem to be apathetic? You know, you can see it in one individual. It might be having a bad stage of life or feeling disengaged because they've had a bad experience with their manager. But there's also organizations that I've seen that have a fairly heavy load of either apathy or resistance that's coming from a place of, as you say, I don't care.
I think the organizations that have the highest rate of apathy are those that have grown significantly by acquisition.
Okay, interesting.
So they just keep buying other organizations, and they haven't done any work to integrate them into one big family. And those people do not see themselves or the organization they've worked so long in represented in the larger mothership.
In the collective.
Yeah.
Interesting. And so is that a case of you know, because there's lots of theories around this. How would you do that differently if you were to bring people together, or how would you help avoid that sense of apathy and a sense of connective tissue?
You need to onboard them properly, like into the fold. Otherwise, it's just another different organization. So, and I think also the challenge is if the head office culture is not that strong, there's nothing for these smaller companies to tether onto. So yes, it's expensive. Yes, it takes time. But yes, for God's sake, it is worth it for all these other entities to feel like they're part of the family. Because otherwise, there's no there's silos, there's no collaboration, there's lots of competition. Mm-hmm. And the reasons that you bought that other organization to begin with, which is probably to leverage economies of scale, to reduce costs, to foster greater collaboration, go after bigger pieces of work, be more profitable, those reasons are not going to be on the table anymore because people don't feel like they're part of the family.
I'm going to change gears a little bit, but this question, I think you're going to have a fair shake at. What's something that most executives know is true but seem to ignore? And perhaps in that truth is an opportunity around change and transformation. So what do they know but potentially ignore or aren't paying attention to?
I would hope they know this, but everything a leader says, does, or doesn't do can either erode or accelerate the transformation that you're trying to achieve.
And going back to that question, they know is true, but find they're not maybe playing it out.
Yeah.
Tell us more about what you see.
They probably think that the rules don't apply to them, that, you know, I want you to do this, but I myself am not gonna take my own medicine. And so they think, look, it's just one time I'm not gonna. I see this a lot in culture change. Mm-hmm. Where CEOs say they want this co-creative culture, they want openness, they want transparency, blah, blah, blah. But then someone gets their head blown off for speaking their mind. So they think, oh, it's just one instance, it's just one this, but there's always just going to be one instance. So I don't think they understand that. Like one is enough. One is enough to traumatize people. One is enough to think that this change is just BS. One is enough for them to check out. So, and I'll give you an example of this. So I was walking down Pitt Street with my girlfriend. We'd been shopping and I said, hey, let's go for lunch. She's like, yeah, okay. So we wandered along and this was when Jimmy's Falafels was just launched. That's on George Street. And it had gotten lots of great write-ups. And a few of my friends had been there too. And I said, let's go there. And she goes, no, like literally less than a split second later, she said, no. I said, why not? Like, it's gotten great reviews. So-and-so's done it. You know, they're foodies. They said great things about it. She said, no, I tried a falafel 8 years ago. It was terrible, not doing it again. So one bad falafel turned her into a lean, mean falafel avoiding machine.
Mm.
But this happens in our organizations all the time. One instance, they see a leader acting, you know, in misalignment with their values. One instance, they have a bad change. That's it. They've set in stone and for years to come.
It's a hard task, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I suppose that's what we sign
that's
up
why,
for.
That's why the success rate is so low.
Because this is the point, right? So some would say, well, it's only once. Can't I be forgiven? Can't we play through this?
You can if you own up to it and are accountable and you're consistently not doing it again.
Mm.
But when you pretend it's not even happening and just glaze over it, I mean, what do you expect people to do?
Yeah, and that gear shift is it takes, you know, that one single event, that symbolic event to crush everything, but it takes a long time to rebuild it, right? So you then on the back end, if you are serious and accountable and responsible for the leader you want to be, to keep showing up, to overcome that symbolic scenario and to be aware of it and then to play through it and actually build that trust again is important.
Like we know you're human. We know you will make mistakes. It's the not owning up to it and the moving on that's a killer to your credibility that you want to see this change through.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I often talk to leaders and I say, look, your staff's bullshit rate is pretty high. You know, yeah. They're human beings. Mm. The difference, and unfortunately, is that they won't always share that bullshit.
Yeah.
They won't call it out. They'll put it in the memory bank and play forward.
Yeah.
And that will accumulate over time. And that can, for an individual who's just getting data points from all around the organization, we get that quiet insurgence of, I guess information that's been planted out there, and it can break things down over time. Your experience in that, I wonder, have you seen situations where you least expected a leader that you thought was pretty impressive, you know, perhaps underperform unexpectedly because of their history?
No, not underperform. Mm. No. Mm.
Good. Mm. The history, as you say, is if they're an effective leader, is probably the way I frame the question. If they're an effective leader, you'd argue that that history has been overcome. But that's part of where I see, in my experience, this lag effect. So there's effective traits of an individual, and some people really admire a leader, but because of event X, it follows them around like a bad smell. And in some cases, they're better off leaving.
There's someone that has overcome that. So I was at a big HR leadership conference, mm. and the topic came up about culture change. Mm. And the former MD of IBM Australia shared his story. And he was very brutally honest and open with it. He said, look, guys, I wasn't sure about this when I first started, but 360 degree feedback came, and it was unanimous that people think I'm an asshole. And there were many, many examples of when I exhibited this behavior. And he was open with it. He goes, and I committed to my people that this is my journey. I'm starting today. Yes, I will make mistakes, but I'm very visible. And then he actually shared on the big screen what his results were, and he showed every quarter how his results improved. And he even said, don't get me wrong, you know, I still make mistakes and I fall back into my old traps, et cetera, but mm-hmm. I'm working on it. And that's the thing. We want to be able to connect with you as leaders. So if you're working on something, be open with your scaffolding. Tell us what you're working on. Like, you know, we're not here to like bag you out all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's when it's unrelatable and they put on this veneer, and that's when it's hard for people to connect.
Yeah. I think that's so smart. And not only smart, it's not, you know, it's not a manipulative smart. It's an EQ. It's a relationship developing strategy. It's normal, and kudos to that person for picking up on it. Can I ask for you personally, what are you working on?
I'm working on my EQ. So I wasn't taught this at schools. Coming from a Southeast Asian background, was never talked about either. So that's my challenge. Talking about emotions makes me very uncomfortable, especially in a work setting as well. So how do you balance that vulnerability, that openness with the professionalism?
Mm. Tell me more.
So the first step is it doesn't come naturally to me, and probably to most people listening, because there's only four core emotions: anger, sadness, happiness, and I can't remember the other one. Mad, sad, bad. Oh, and bad. So we're not giving the language, but there's so many. There's over 60 different emotions. Whereas people, for example, in Norway, they're taught this from little kindy and early stage primary school. So they're very comfortable with it. And, you know, after I've been to Norway, and even when they're having kind of emotional conversations, it's still quite cool, calm and collected, because it's just like, it's just a regular conversation, but we're talking about feelings and fears instead of feeds and speeds. So I want to normalize myself with that, given that I work across different nationalities, different cultures. It's to broaden my worldview.
Yeah, mm. I love that. And have you found, as you've leaned into it, that, you know, the you're getting more in touch with your own emotions? Are you getting clearer about how you feel about situations?
Yes, and to check, and the practice to check in first. And if I'm having trouble identifying what it is, I actually literally have emotional cards that where it makes it easy for me, because I can see all 60 of them or whatever laid out, and I'm like, ah, yes, that's it. So until I get better and better at identifying it myself, at labeling, I'm using physical tools.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
That's you are taking it seriously.
I am taking it seriously.
So what's forced you or caused you to take it so seriously? What, you know, some people would say, oh, you know, got to read the room a bit better, or got to, you know, got to be a bit more connected to other people's emotions, or be a bit more empathetic. But it sounds like, from what you're telling me, that's a genuine shift that you're going through. What's forcing or causing that?
Well, everybody has them. Everybody can feel sad. Everybody can feel happy, whereas values can differ. Education can differ. Perception can differ. And you remember the good old iceberg model where you see the behaviors on top, blah, blah, blah. Well, underneath perceptions, education, beliefs, et cetera, it all starts with emotion, how we respond to something. Mm. So you need to start from the deep below surface to change what's on the top of the iceberg.
Mm. And you know that the results will be different.
Mm.
Mm. So in change, and this is what I've found myself, is, you know, I've made some blunders over my career, as we all do. But I think one of the things that's connected with me is just being really deliberate about understanding how people are going to experience something.
Mm.
Because for me personally, the one of the biggest challenges I have is that I assume other people are going to get it like I get it. And knowing that I know that now helps me a lot.
Yeah.
Are there sort of watch out points that you have that you say, oh, okay, in this particular project or working with this executive group, this is what I really need to remind myself?
What you just said then about I want to know how this change is going to, how people are going to experience this change. I actually think, how do I want people to feel from this experience?
Mm-hmm.
And if I want them to feel joyful, what am I going to do to amplify joy? What do I need to do? What do I need to say? What do the leaders need to do, et cetera? And I flip it too. What do I not want people to feel?
Mm-hmm.
Disconnected could be one of them. How do we avoid that disconnection? So actually explicitly mapping out what you're going to do and what you're not going to do to either amplify or minimize certain feelings.
Mm. That's really cool to deliberately map that out. What's something, just if we look at a negative feeling, so resist or something that drives resistance, right? Mm. Like an anger,
yeah.
or a sense of sadness about loss, right?
Yeah.
So if you know that's a risk, what are some tactics you've used to in environments where you think that's a big risk and I need to address it?
I actually like to ask them about it to remind themselves of a particular big change in their life and how they felt about it at the time. So it could be birth of your first child, it could be moving countries, it could be blah, blah, blah. And I'd map it out, and usually they'll say things like scared, you know, unsure, am I making the right decision, yada, yada. And I say, okay, now that you're here today, 2024, how do you feel about that change? What were the benefits that happened from you embarking on that change? And they'll be like, my career shot off. I was like, oh, I ended up having 3 kids, you know, moved across the world for this woman. It's like my biggest love ever. And from that, it's enough to make them shift that at that moment, it was scary. They pushed back against it, blah, blah. But with hindsight, these are all the things they were able to do as a result. So I asked them to think about a personal big change that they're glad they took, but at the time they were pushing back against.
Yeah, such an effective strategy, because we've all had that.
Mm.
And it's that idea of like bounded rationality, right? In a small decision that I make today, will I have a coffee or not or whatever? Mm. These are just decisions that we can feel happy or sad about right now.
Yeah.
But to have that bound of thinking 3 months out, 6 months out, 12 months out, people struggle with that in the short term, because the short term is so immediate in terms of the emotional response. So I suppose you're always grappling that balance between how we feel now and how we feel about the big play.
Mm.
I one of the things I've learned, and one of the things I've at times in my own business struggled with, is celebrating the wins.
Yeah, me too.
Particularly the little
fever.
Wins.
Yeah. next mountain.
Yeah. And for me, that's because I get excited by the big mountain.
Yeah.
That fires me up. But I know for a lot of people that's super intimidating. Tell me about your experience around celebrating wins.
I may not do a physical celebration or ritual, but I do reflect back quarterly on what's happened since then, what I should be thankful for. People tell me all the time I should take more time to stop, smell the roses and celebrate. So it's something that I'm cognizant of.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm. Because I do this for change projects. Like if it was a physical, back in the good old days, pre-COVID, there was always some massive change and transformation wall. and we'd put up our wins on there. So every time someone walked past the foyer, every time someone went to get a coffee, they're reminded of what we're all here to do and pushing towards.
Yeah.
So it's like a pride shrine. So I read about this concept when I was watching The Blue Zones, which is a documentary about people that live the longest in the world. So clusters of people that consistently live to 110 years old,
yeah.
A pride shrine was one of them. They're reminded of their purpose in life and what they're striving for.
It's interesting, right? Because you know that you've deliberately implemented it for other people, but for yourself, a bit more challenging.
Work in progress.
Work in progress. Okay. We're all an imperfect project, right?
Yeah.
So Friska, there are all sorts of transformations, right? And you said nice and early on in the conversation that the role of them is to deliver genuine value to the organization.
Yeah.
Now, I often talk to people in the process of change around the idea of learning and complexity and the importance of making good decisions or probable bets around, you know, human behavior or new processes sticking and are being adopted. And that's in the detail. But when we go at the more macro level, there's this conversation I have around regrettable bets, you know, making big decisions that have fairly heavy resource attached to it.
Yeah.
And we don't really want to turn around on. When you're discussing change with leaders, you know, how clear are they on the fact that some of these bets are potentially what we might describe as regrettable? And how do you help them understand that regret or explore that regret or potential for regret in terms of planning out the change?
So a few things. Sometimes even though you want to, you literally cannot go back. For example, if you're tethered to a large software company and it's going to cost you more to dismantle it than go forward, that's painful, but you just need to swallow it and get on with it. The second is when at your steerco meetings, exco meetings, whatever regular meetings you have with the decision makers, you should always be linking your change activities to the value that's aiming to be created. And when the gap that gets so small that it doesn't make sense to proceed, that's when you need to highlight that like way, way earlier. Like, for example, you know, there's say 20 countries and now 15 of them are really dead set against this because of geopolitical reasons, whatever it is. So that was an unexpected change, caught you by surprise. And so it's things like that that happen and you need to be able to recognize a bad bet when it does happen and have the guts to actually cut it and siphon those resources elsewhere,
yeah.
Right? Because starting stuff is easy. Like we talked about this before about the unlearning, like learning a new language, trying to get fit, losing 5 kilos. Starting that is easy. Finishing it is hard.
Yeah.
And it's the same with projects.
Yeah.
So when it's becoming clearer and clearer that the effort to get it across the line and get those benefits, the effort is actually more expensive than it benefits itself, then it doesn't make sense to continue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, you talked about that example of a geopolitical piece, yeah. which might be arguably unpredictable or definitely might have come out of left field and, you know, might have been something we haven't been able to do the research on. But then you've got other parts of regrettable bets. And I see this with, you know, where transformations technically just a big system upgrade or something like that. And it's really disruptive for staff across the organization and it takes a lot of headspace.
Mm.
And I see this situation where we know it's a pretty heavy bet, but we really aren't doing our homework, you know, and you get to the end and there's this sort of lag between we kicked off, things happen, and all of a sudden there's this huge budget blowout.
Yeah.
You know, what's your experience around that? What are some of the big drivers that you see for causing that, and what can leaders look out for?
I think that happens a lot because I've been doing a lot of research on this for my second book. That happens a lot with Western companies that are trying to enter into Asia. They totally misguided, maybe got the wrong advice. They don't realize things take longer there. Like developing relationships take longer, developing trust takes longer. So Walmart, for example, they were there for 10 years before they finally pulled up stumps and went back to the US because it just wasn't working. They don't understand the environment. They don't understand the culture. They don't understand who they're trying to engage. And I think the biggest misstep for them is they underestimated the power of relationships and networks and this concept of Guangxi, which is all about the bamboo network. So it's really hard to break in if you're a foreigner. But once you have it for life, like you're trusted for life. And that doesn't really, again, there's a structural mismatch with how people are remunerated. They're remunerated against quarterly results like profits, revenue, et cetera. And again, they don't realize that this sort of change takes a lot of investment and time to get hold of.
Mm. It seems obvious when you hit, when you play it back like that. You do the research, you understand the drivers, you understand what's going to go on. You look at what's predictable, you look at what's embedded in either a cultural issue or systematic issue or technology capability or whatever it is. It just sometimes the homework's not done.
Well, they think they have done. And this all stems from a lack of diversity. If people that are doing the homework are all, you know, MBA graduates from Harvard and they think they've got the best brains trust in the room, but the theory and the models and the frameworks, et cetera, does not prepare you for what actually happens on the ground.
Mm. Yeah, and whether it's getting on the ground in Asia or whether it's getting on the ground with a 100%. Technology change or bring the right people in the room, get the experts in the room earlier and listen to them. Mm. And instead of, you know, sort of leaving it as a data point that sits on a PowerPoint somewhere that you know, really understand the nuance rather than glossing over it, because often it's in that detail that's where the devil lives, right?
Yeah. And I think also a lot of I'm making a huge generalization, obviously, don't send hate mail, but usually it's a very more transactional concept in the Western world, whereas the Eastern is all about relationships and trust. So one of my friends, he's a German, he's lived 27 years in China, and it took him 11 years of catch-ups with a big OEC manufacturer to finally get the deal. And even the OEC manufacturer said, why do you keep catching up with me for lunch? Like, we're not doing business together. And he's like, I just want to share value with you. I just want to learn from you, and I'm here to openly share what I'm doing too. Took him 11 years to crack it, but after 11 years, worth $500 million deal.
Mm.
Who has that patience to do that? Very rarely does anyone.
Very rarely, yeah.
And not only did he have the patience to do that, but he was supported by his boss to do that. He's like, keep doing it. We'll crack it one day. It's that belief.
You actually have to have a vision.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you got to understand what the road is you're trying to travel. Easier said than done. But it's like, look, Frisk, it's been really interesting. And to be honest, I've been jagging and zigzagging all over the place. And I'm sure for listeners that, you know, can be interesting because it's moving us along to different ideas. But it's also, you know, really cool to hear just the way you've responded to things in the moment today. You know, in terms of just sort of heading towards a close, what are some of the things you really hope, you know, you can land or you'd want to leave with people to think about, regardless of where they're at on deliberate transformation? What are some of the things that we can take away from today's discussion or you might want to leave?
So I'll finish off with one of my favorite quotes. It's by Alvin Toffler, who's a futurist, and he said, the illiterate of the future will not be those that cannot read or write, but those that cannot learn, relearn, and unlearn. So learning's great, but unlearning is just as important. So what are those mindsets, behaviors, et cetera, that are holding you down, that are keeping you tethered to where you are today, and how can you start to systematically unlearn them?
Confronting question for some. I think it's a great one to ponder on. I'm also pondering that on myself at the moment, going through a bit of change. Really nice way to finish. Frisk, I really enjoyed today. For anyone that really did get a lot of value out of today, we've got the Future Fit Organization book here. Where can they get it, and what's the easiest place?
Easiest place is either Amazon or Barnes & Noble online.
Very good.
Yeah.
Very good. Frisk, it's been awesome. Where are you going now? What's on next?
I'm speaking at a panel later tonight for International Women's Day.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Yeah. What do you think they're going to talk to you about?
Personal resilience, overcoming challenges, backing yourself, how to craft a path to your own destiny.
Mm. You're a good role model for that, I think. So, Frisco, appreciate it. I hope you enjoyed tonight. I really appreciate it today. And we'll let you run.
Thanks very much.